From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The story of income inequality has been told over and over. It fueled Donald Trump's rise to the White House. It got Hillary Clinton's voters to the polls. Go back to Occupy Wall Street. The Tea Party, too, arguably fed on that gnawing sense that even when the economy roars ahead, regular working people are stuck in the breakdown lane. History says inequality is a stubborn thing, but does it have to be so large? This hour on Point, American inequality as a new administration comes to town. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. The big national aggregate economic numbers are looking up. How about your town, your family? Did you vote for Donald Trump to give the regular guy, regular gal a fair shot at bettering themselves? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Two voices here. First, Donald Trump, at his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention in July, said he wakes up every day determined to deliver a better life for Americans who've been ignored, neglected, and abandoned. Here he was in that speech.
I have visited the laid-off factory workers and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals. These are the forgotten men and women of our country. And they are forgotten, but they're not going to be forgotten long. These are people who work hard, but no longer have a voice. I am your voice.
All right. The voice is headed for the White House. It's not all fun out there. Part of the Fight for 15 protests in November, here was a Burger King employee, Aisha Meadows McLaurin, explaining why that movement, law far away from the Trump Tower golden walls, why that movement wants to increase minimum wages for fast food and other workers, why it's important to her and her family.
I joined Fight for 15 because $10.50 is not enough to raise my family. I'm currently in school, doing hella stuff, just trying to actually take care of my family and raise on $10.50. That's why I joined 5 to 15. I'm striking because making $10.50 is not enough.
Making $10.50 an hour is not enough. With us now from Berkeley, California, is Gabriel Zuckman, assistant professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, co-author with Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez of a new study on income inequality in America, a follow-up to their previous research. You can link to the report at our website, onpointradio.org. He's also author of the book, The Hidden Wealth of Nations. Gabriel Zuckman, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Stanford, California, is Walter Scheidel, professor of classics and history at Stanford and author of the upcoming book, The Great Leveler, Violence and the History of Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century. He studied inequality through history, when it got worse, what it took to change it. Walter Scheidel, welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Gabriel, we've paid a lot of attention to this over a long time on this show. You know, an equal society, you really never find that. But you can get kind of grotesque inequality. You all have pointed out just how huge it is these days, and you've done it for a while. What did you find in this new study? What were you looking for in your latest research? What did you find?
So in this new study that we've just released, we've tried to compute comprehensive measures of income inequality. And the most striking finding is that we found that for the bottom half of the income distribution, so 120 million adults with the income in the bottom half of the distribution, their income has not grown at all since 1980. So the average income in the bottom half of the distribution was $16,000 in 1980, and it's still $16,000 today. So you have half of the population that's been shut off from economic growth. And that's in sharp contrast with what has happened at the top, where income has been skyrocketing. So for the top 1%, average income has been multiplied by 3 since 1980. For the top 0.1%, it's been multiplied by 4. For the top 0.001%, it's been multiplied by 7. So you really have two entirely different economies, one half of the population that's not growing at all, and one the very tippy top of the pyramid that's growing at incredibly fast rates.
Walter, we have known about inequality for a while, and we've seen it go back toward historic highs, at least for our country. You write about how difficult it is to change inequality once it sets in. For a lot of Americans who grew up in the 20th century, this may not immediately resonate. They grew up after World War II. There was a relatively broad distribution of income compared to what we have now, relatively flat compared to now. Did they grow up in an odd time, Walter? People who think that's just the way it was or should be.
They grew up in a very odd time. It's one of the most exceptional periods in history in that it was possible to have a massive economic expansion, a growing middle class at a time of very moderate or even falling inequality in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But that was really a development rooted in the preceding very massive, very violent dislocations of World War I, the Great Depression, especially World War II. And that really ties in with the finding in my book that if you look at history in a very long run over hundreds of thousands of years, you see that only massive violent shocks were really capable of substantially decreasing inequality of income and wealth. And mass mobilization warfare, like in World War I, World War II, is one of them, the others being transformative revolution, again a phenomenon of the 20th century, if you think of the Soviet Union or China, state collapse, and massive epidemics. It's a very grim picture, but this pattern seems to have held true across history all the way up into the 20th century.
We are not here to advocate massive violence or plagues by any means, but having seen a country that was much more equal than it is now, you can understand the urge for people not to lose that. Why has it taken massive violence in the past, or why has massive violence brought some sort of leveling of inequality?
It seems that inequality is extremely resilient. It's almost like a default condition of civilized societies going back literally thousands of years. So it is exceptional for inequality to drop substantially and very rapidly the way it did in the 40s and 50s. And what happened, of course, was a combination of any number of factors, destruction of capital value, extremely high marginal tax rates to fund the war effort, massive state intervention in the private sector, in the economy, and any number of knock-on effects, extensions of the franchise, an enormous increase in labor union membership, and ultimately the construction of the modern welfare state, which is in a very meaningful way a direct outgrowth of World War II. And all these various processes really led to massive redistribution on a scale not seen before. The fiscal power of the state grew enormously. Its interventionism in the economy expanded enormously. And as a result of this, this really shaped the way the gains from the subsequent economic expansion, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, were distributed among the population. And this one generation was really the main beneficiary of this particular development, which seems very hard to replicate now or in the future.
Gabriel Zuckman, you know, we've got Walter Scheidel pointing out in The Great Leveler these astonishing numbers that the richest 62 people on the planet owned as much private net wealth as the bottom half of all humanity, 3.5 billion, that the richest 1% of the world's households now hold more than half of global private net wealth. Why has this concentration grown, Gabriel?
Well, I think that policies, economic and social policies, matter a great deal. So I very much agree with Walter that shocks and wars and things like that, you know, shape the distribution of income and have played a key role in reducing income and wealth concentration at some point in history. But I have a slightly more optimistic view about the concrete role that policies can have. Policies can really reduce inequality as they've done in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, as they still do today in a number of countries outside of the US. In continental Europe, there's much less income and wealth inequality than in the US. And on the other hand, policies can, of course, exacerbate inequality, and that's what's been happening in the US since 1980, the upsurge in income concentration. That's a direct result from less progressive taxation, from the deregulation of the financial industry, from all sorts of policies that have boosted income at the top and at the same time that have led to stagnation of middle-class income, such as, you know, the erosion of the minimum wage, the lower power of unions. And so That, I think, explains a lot of the rise in income concentration in the US. But if policies have been able to increase inequality so dramatically as they've done in the US over the last three decades, they also have the power, government also has the power to make America equitable again, or at least to make economic growth equally distributed again if those policies are reverted.
What's the problem with inequality, Gabriel, apart from just offending the sense of justice, of human justice at some point? What's the problem with it?
Well, the problem is there's not necessarily any problem with inequality per se. It all depends on, what's the magnitude of income and wealth inequality. Some inequality is good. It gives incentives to people to work hard and to save and to innovate, and that's great. Too much inequality, extreme inequality, on the other hand, can be detrimental to growth, can lead to forms of political capture. Simply put, billionaires, they don't need social security. They don't need all those government programs that play such an important role for the middle class and for low-wage workers. And so if they don't need it, well, there's a real chance that they will get rid of it. Okay, and so that's one of the reasons why we care so much about inequality. I think political capture is a very real risk and problem.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American income inequality, deep and stubborn, even as the economy has recovered. What to do about it? What Donald Trump will or won't do about it? You can join us this hour. Do you feel the deep inequality across our economy, our society now? Did you vote for Donald Trump to say, hey, enough already, let's turn this around? Do you see how the rich, the affluent, have done very well, while millions have dropped out of the growth game, the economic growth game, been stuck? And what moves, what policies might get more of us back in the same boat, a good boat? Donald Trump, throughout his campaign, saying he'd stand up for average Americans who he saw as left out, stand up for opportunity. Here he is once more from the Republican convention.
I am your voice. So to every parent who dreams for their child, and every child who dreams for their future, I say these words to you tonight. I am with you, I will fight for you, and I will win for you.
The promise, very broad, of Donald Trump. Gabriel Zuckman is with us with Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez. He's out with a big new batch of research on what's going on with inequality in this country. The bottom half stuck since 1980, the top and the tip-top soaring. Walter Scheidel is with us, professor of classics and history at Stanford University, author of the forthcoming The Great Leveler. He says it's awfully hard to really shake these things once they get going. Catherine Rampell joins us in just a moment from The Washington Post. She's thinking about Donald Trump policy that we may see roll out in his administration. Callers, though, first for the two of you, Gabriel and Walter. Ray in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi to your guests.
Hi.
You mentioned the year 1980. That's right around the time that I entered the workforce, and I'm a stagehand in Milwaukee, and that's where Donald Trump actually spoke last night, and the union set up his staging.
Okay.
I wasn't there, but my union set that up.
Yep.
My wages stayed flat or actually went down until the year 2000. So from 1980 to the year 2000, working in staging, I saw wages go down, and they're still at that depressed level at all the non-union theaters in Milwaukee. The only way I saw wage increase, Tom, was by joining a union in the year 2000, IOTC. And since then, I've had benefits, and I've seen my wages go up slightly every year for the last 16 years. So the answer to our problem in this country, unionize people at McDonald's. Unionize the maintenance people. Unionize everybody who is not had a voice in unions. That is the answer.
But it's just gone the other way, as you well know, Ray. I mean, unions have become a smaller and smaller percentage of our workforce. There's hardly a tidal wave going on to turn that around.
But we should start at the bottom again, like unionizing all the McDonald's workers in this country would make a huge change in the right direction, and then slowly dig into all the other areas where unions have not tried to organize.
Bring them back.
Says, that. Without a collective voice, we are never going to be heard. Ever.
Ray, we've got it right on the table, and we'll come to it. Let me hold that. One more here. Stu in Atlanta, Georgia. Stu, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I guess my comment is that I don't understand why more corporations don't incorporate profit sharing, where when they have to pay lower wages, everybody can benefit when the company benefits. My family did it for years in the scrap iron business, where you had to buy to get the best values to buy in depressed economies where you couldn't pay high wages across the board, but you could keep people working and then share the wealth when the tide turns. That's my comment.
A little more profit sharing when those profits are good, even if wages aren't great, maybe the ultimate distribution would be better. I'm going to hold those two. Walter Gabriel, stand by. Catherine Rampell joins us right now, columnist for The Washington Post, joins us from New York today. Catherine, thanks a lot for being here.
Good to be here.
We heard Donald Trump say, you know, I am your voice. And he was talking, it seemed, to working men and women in this country who felt that they had been forgotten, left behind, left out of the gravy train that some have been on. That seems to speak directly to inequality. Now we see the Trump cabinet coming together. We see Trump policies in the wings, waiting, some of them vague, some of them more specific, waiting for implementation, or at least an effort at implementation. Is there a game plan out there under Donald Trump, Catherine, that you see as going at this sort of huge wealth gap in this country, income and wealth gap?
If anything, I see the opposite. As you rightly pointed out, a lot of his policies are vague, and he, I think, has been purposely vague and kind of all over the map. But there are some issues on which he has been fairly consistent that would actually increase inequality. For example, he would make the tax system much less progressive. He is likely to repeal or at least greatly reduce the estate tax, which effectively allows very wealthy people to continue to pass on their assets to their children, which perpetuates wealth inequality, of course. On a number of other policy issues, it seems likely that he would do things that would at the very least not help the lowest wage earners. So, for example, his pick for labor secretary has expressed opposition to raising the minimum wage, potentially getting rid of the federal minimum wage altogether. Trump himself has kind of been all over the map about his own views about the minimum wage, but that in and of itself would, of course, potentially lower the amount of income going to McDonald's workers, for example.
Yep.
He has also waged a partial war on unionization. You know, he picked a big fight with a union leader in Indiana and has attacked unions in the past. So a number of the kinds of issues that we're talking about, it seems like, if anything, he would go in the opposite direction when it comes to reducing inequality, if anything.
Catherine, what about trade? And what about straight-up economic growth? He's promised to change the balance of trade in favor of the American economy, American workers, and he's promised to bring on much stronger growth. Wouldn't those go to diminish this canyon of wealth that he would say globalization has helped create?
If you actually believe that he is going to improve trade deals and grow the economy, then that has the potential to put more money in the pockets of lower wage earners or middle wage earners. It also has the potential to help the highest earners. But again, you have to buy the premise that he would actually change these kinds of policies for the better and would increase economic growth. If you look at a number of analyses that have come out from both Wall Street economists and those working at, you know, ratings agencies and think tanks about his general suite of economic proposals, everything from imposing major tariffs on imports to mass deportation of undocumented workers, et cetera, the general pattern seems to be that economic growth would increase in the near term because we'd have this major stimulus in the form of tax cuts, for example.
Yep. Yep.
But over the long run, it would actually reduce economic growth and would increase unemployment. So if we have a major recession, which is, you know, we will have a recession at some point. That's just the nature of the business cycle. But mm-hmm. if we have a very large one, potentially triggered by some of these policies, that disparately hurts workers at the bottom of the income distribution because they get thrown out of work.
Gabriel Zucman, let's be generous here with Donald Trump to begin with. Let's say that he does get higher economic growth. Does that address the inequality problem, this huge canyon sitting in the middle of our economy, Gabriel?
No, of course, it's not enough. You know, it's not enough to have growth. What you need is to have growth that's equally distributed, so equitable growth. Look, since 1980, average income per adult has increased 61%. So there's been a fair amount of growth over the last 36 years. Mm-hmm. But there's been zero growth at the very same time for half of the population. So it's just not enough. You need growth, but that's widely shared. And I totally agree with Catherine that all the policies that Donald Trump is probably going to implement, lower, less progressive taxation, you know, more deregulation in the financial industry, a very anti-minimum wage, anti-union stance, all of this is not going to generate growth for the bottom half of the distribution or for the middle class. It's going to maybe create even more growth at the very, very top. So a continuation and an acceleration of the policies and the inequality dynamics that we've been witnessing since the 1980s, that's the most likely outcome if Donald Trump, you know, applies his program.
What about a change in the trade balance? He's been very loud addressing the American trade deals and says he wants to change them, make them more favorable to the U.S., bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. I think to many ears that sounds like a path toward better wages, maybe less inequality.
It might, you know, have a role. However, if you take the you know, the long view, the decline in manufacturing employment, it's mostly a technology story. You know, it's a technological change that has led to the decline in manufacturing employment in the United States much more than trade deals. So I'm very actually skeptical that better deals could make a significant difference to that trend.
Walter Scheidel, what about in time? You've looked at this over history. This must not be the first time that someone has come along in a time of great inequality and said loudly to a people, I'm going to change this. I'm going to make things better for more people. In the absence of some other large event, what's the history of people being successful in doing that? You've just witnessed, along with everybody else, the political transition in this country. Does it promise change?
Well, ordinarily, people were only capable of doing this if they implemented extreme measures, the likes of which we couldn't possibly imagine in this country. As I said earlier, if you have some kind of communist revolution, then of course you can substantially lower inequality.
What about the New Deal? That was seen as extreme.
The New Deal. Well, actually, I thought the first caller made a really important point, mm-hmm. because union membership is meaningfully correlated with inequality. You have higher union density and lower inequality. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it historically, union membership went through the roof in the 30s because of New Deal legislation. Yeah. And during the war, it peaked in the late 1940s and has been going down ever since. Now, there have always been constituencies opposed to unions. They were just less successful in a way back then compared to how successful they are now. And that shows that all these various policy measures really have to be properly contextualized. They may work very well in certain contexts, in the contexts of these violent dislocations, but less well, they are far more difficult to implement in the world today when we have much more stability, globalization, and so on.
Catherine Rempel, a call for you. Ron in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Ron, you're on with Catherine Rempel.
Thank you, Mr. Ashcroft, and hello, panel. I'd like to ask a question, and I'll start off with just a really quick story. I entered the workforce during the first Bush presidency, and I was making a little bit better than minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
I realized I needed better education, better skills. I went out, and I ended up eventually getting a degree. My wife now has a master's degree. We both make very good money, and we've made smart choices. I make over $80,000 a year in a very, you know, kind of depressed area.
Good for you.
Currently, I'm driving a 2007 Hyundai Elantra instead of a Mercedes-Benz.
Okay.
We didn't have children. Now, I contrast that to your soundbite you had earlier about the young lady that was making $10.50 an hour,
yep,
working at Burger King trying to take care of her children. So I'd like to know what your panel says about the income inequality situation, about the individual's responsibility in making sure that they make better and good choices to further their potential.
Hey, Ron, I will definitely put that to the panel here, but let me just ask you, given that the entire bottom half of the population hasn't budged since 1980. Do you think that means that they're all making lousy choices? That's half the 120 million people?
Well, I can't obviously talk about each individual person, but I think that as a trend in the United States, we encourage consumerism. We encourage people to go into debt to buy toys. You know, I have friends of mine that started the same job I had, and they're still there, and I've been promoted 16 times.
Ron, we've got it, and we'll pick it straight up. Catherine, what about individual responsibility in the face of policies and circumstances and opportunity?
Certainly, individuals have agency within the constraints that they are born into. They have choices that they can make. But I don't think that believing that is incompatible with the idea that we can make better policy choices as a nation that enable people to get ahead, to seize more opportunities. So your caller, for example, talked about education, and I do believe that education is plays a very important role in upward mobility. But there's also a role for government to make sure that educational institutions are actually providing the product that they promise their students. And so, for example, this administration, the Obama administration, has actively pursued basically fraud cases or cases of misrepresentation against some for-profit institutions that have been very adept at getting federal student loans or Pell Grants to support very low-income students, but they're not actually delivering a product to those students, an educational product that enables them to get a job. So there have been, you know, there's been very aggressive regulation and enforcement of existing law to try to make sure that there are consumer protections so that students are better informed about what kinds of programs will get them jobs and are not being essentially lied to. Now, contrast that with what we have actually seen with a number of for-profit colleges. And I don't mean to say that all of them are bad, but there are some bad actors. You've actually seen stock prices for those that are publicly traded go through the roof since the election because there is a perception that there will be much more lax regulation of these kinds of educational institutions, maybe looser accreditation standards, et cetera. So, again, you know, there are lots of people who want to get ahead who will pursue the very same strategy as our caller and say, I'm going to use education to increase my opportunity, to help me lift myself up by my own bootstraps.
Yep.
But if you don't have a system in place through policies, through enforcement, et cetera, that actually guides them or at least protects them from getting sort of hoodwinked, then they might try to make the very same choices and think that they're making good choices and actually end up without a degree, without a job, and mountains of debt.
Gabriel Zuckman, what about Ron's point? Hey, what about individual initiative in the face of this inequality?
Yeah, well, I would point that the choices that you can make when you earn $16,000 a year, which is the average income per adult for half of the population, are pretty limited. The choices in terms of education in the face of booming, soaring higher education costs in particular. It's just very hard when you earn $16,000 to enroll, you know, at a later stage in life into higher education programs. So, yes, of course, there's a role for individual responsibility. Nobody denies this. But there's also a very big role for government policies in lifting income for the majority of the population.
When we come back after a short break, we're going to talk with Steve Novick from Portland, Oregon, commissioner of the city there. They've just crafted a bill to raise taxes on companies that pay their CEOs more than 100 times what their average worker makes. There's a move. Catherine Rampell at the Washington Post. I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about American income inequality, deep and stubborn, even as the economy has recovered, what to do about it, what Donald Trump will or won't do about it. Do you see, feel inequality across the economy, our society now? Do you see it in your community? Is Walter Scheidel right? You've got to have a big blow up to shake up inequality, depression, New Deal, world war. How do we stay a united country if we live on different economic planets? What about Portland, Oregon's idea? Pay too much to the top, you get hit with more taxes. We're going to dive right in on that. Gabriel Zuckman is with us. His research has people talking about this, along with Thomas Piketty and Ed, and Mr. Saez there. They're looking again and deeply at inequality in this country and where it's gone and not. Since 1980, the bottom half stuck, while the top 1 and 0.1 and 0.001 soaring in their income. Walter Scheidel is with us from Stanford University, author of the forthcoming The Great Leveler, Violence and the History of Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century. He says it takes a lot to change entrenched inequality. With us right now as well from Portland, Oregon, is Steve Novick. He's commissioner of the city of Portland, one of the commissioners there. He crafted a bill to raise the business tax on companies that pay their CEOs more than 100 times what the average worker makes. And last week, the city passed that bill. Steve Novick, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Exactly how will, I guess the word is, will this work?
The way it'll work is there's about 540 publicly traded companies that do enough business in Portland that they pay our tax on business profits.
Okay.
So next year, when the SEC requirement the companies disclose the ratio between what the CEO makes and the typical worker makes, our revenue bureau will look at the list of publicly traded companies paying our tax, and they'll look at the SEC ratios. And if a company is paying its CEO more than 100 times what it pays its average worker, then they will pay an extra 10% on top of whatever they would have been paying otherwise. If the ratio is more than 250-1, they'll pay an extra 25% on top of what they would have been paying otherwise.
So I'm guessing if it's 500-plus companies, we're talking about some pretty big names here. Like who are we talking about?
Well,
on the list.
I don't know what the ratios are. I could guess like Walmart would be one of them, you know, General Electric, Goldman Sachs.
Okay.
Mostly big national companies. Only a small fraction of these companies are headquartered here.
Do they have to do what you ask? If little Portland asks, you know, Goldman Sachs to pay an extra 10 or 25%, do they have to do it?
Well, yes, they do. They pay our business income tax now. It's the law. They would have to pay a little more.
What kind of response have you had?
Well, the local Chamber of Commerce had kind of a generic ideological response opposing it. It's very popular with people in organized labor. It's very popular with the general public. We've been delighted by the national response we've gotten. I really appreciate the chance to be on your show because we know that the Fortune 500 isn't going to change its ways because of just what Portland does. What we're hoping is that numerous other jurisdictions will pick up on this, just as numerous cities have passed their own minimum wages and paid sick leave proposals. And if enough jurisdictions do this, then the shareholders of America will realize that the after-tax profits they have to divvy up are diminishing because of these extreme CEO pay ratios, and they'll start to rein in CEO pay.
So what
the pay of average workers.
Maybe so. What exactly, though, are you trying to accomplish here? Are you just looking for more revenue for the city of Portland to make the parks greener, I don't know what, or do you think you've got the leverage to actually bring down these huge disparities in pay ratios?
Well, the primary purpose is to try to reduce inequality. Yes, we will raise a little bit of money for parks and housing and police and fire, but the primary intent is to start a movement to address inequality in compensation by getting other jurisdictions to do the same thing. Now, I first read about this idea a couple of years ago. It was proposed in the California State Senate by State Senator Mark DeSaulnier, who actually is now in Congress and has introduced the same idea in Congress. And it was suggested to him by a California philanthropist named Steve Silverstein. And I was very excited when I read about it because it struck me as the closest thing I'd ever seen to a tax on inequality itself. And a bit later, I was looking through Thomas Piketty's book, and I'd always thought of extreme CEO pay as being just one dramatic example of rising inequality. Piketty says it's a major driving force. As you know, it's not just the top 1%, it's especially the top 0.1%
yeah.
that has far more wealth, income, and power than it did 40 years ago. What Piketty says is that 60 to 70% of the members of the top one-tenth of 1% in America are top executives at large firms. So if you could do something about extreme CEO pay, you could do something about extreme inequality generally.
Gabriel Zucman, you're listening there in California. Do you see a tax solution to the inequality problem? I mean, your new research looks at all the transfers or all the government programs that help the poor and the working class in this country. And even with all of those, we still see this flat line since 1980, zero growth, while others have grown a lot. Is there a tax solution to inequality, Gabriel?
I think so, yes. History shows that progressive taxation can be a very effective tool in reducing income and wealth disparities. From the 1930s to 1980s, so for half a century, the top marginal income tax rate in the U.S. was 82%. On average, and sometimes as high as 90%. That was also the period of time when income and wealth inequality was at a historically low level. And the reasons for this are not hard to understand. If top executives and very high earners in general face very high marginal income tax rates for incomes of above $1 or $2 million a year, for instance, as was the case, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, mm-hmm. then what happens is that they have just less incentives to try to extract rents, to try to bargain very high salaries and compensation packages, which in turn makes it easier for low-wage workers and middle earners to actually get more income. They get a greater fraction of the pie. So I think progressive taxation can both reduce the concentration of income and wealth at the very, very top and can help middle income and low wages grow much more than they've grown since the 1980s.
Walter Scheidel, what about the power ratio here? Here's Steve Novick in Portland, Oregon, the city of Portland voting to say, hey there, you know, Walmart, GE, Goldman Sachs, don't pay your top guys so much. We're going to take a 10% bite out of what, you know, over here. That's a pretty small nibble when you look at the size of these companies. Do you see adequate power if Portland does that, if 10 other cities do that, if 100 other cities do that, to really change inequality here?
It may change inequality, but probably not on a very large scale. History shows that those measures were at the most effective if they were implemented at the national level, right? If the entire United States adopted such measures, it would make a real difference. If all developed countries adopted similar measures, it would make an even bigger difference, right? So it's really a question of scale.
Steve Novick, you're there in Portland, and you've done your bit trying at the local level. But here we got Walter Scheidel looking out across all of history, all the way back to Rome, and saying, you know, it takes calamities. It takes a plague or a war or a revolution to change inequality. Are you willing to concede that, Steve?
Well, I think that there is a fair amount of evidence on Walter's side, but you've got to try. And he's absolutely right. Ideally, these policies get adopted at the national level and the international level. But I think, unfortunately, she did not win the Electoral College vote, but you saw Hillary Clinton talking about paid sick leave, which a couple of years ago was just something a couple of cities were talking about. You see Theresa May, the conservative prime minister of Britain, calling for a rule like the SEC rule that requires the disclosure of the ratio of CEO pay to typical worker pay in the United Kingdom. I think that this idea of taxation based on the ratio of CEO pay to typical worker pay is something that could easily, over the next 10 years, be adopted not only by local and state governments, but by national governments. One thing about it is it's really easy to grasp. I mean, it's that people can look at those ratios and know that they're outrageous. In fact, 62% of Americans think there should be an absolute cap on CEO pay, not just a tax on extreme CEO pay. I think that it's a very hard thing to argue against that companies that pay their CEOs these outrageous sums should pay a tax penalty.
Well, I mean, plus we all know that for a long time, CEOs did just fine without making hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times what their average employee made. Al in Baltimore is calling. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I have a couple of basic things that I'm interested in first, and I think most people are, mm-hmm. and that's I'd like to have a health care system plan as good as maybe the Senate, and I'd like to feel secure in my own home like the average senator. And if I had that, we're three quarters of the way to happiness.
How are you going to get that, Al? You know, there are plenty of millionaires and maybe even some billionaires in the Senate these days.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. And they weren't when they went in. But once they got in, they got little perks like the insider information law doesn't apply to them. And
yeah, well, a bunch are pretty well off when they went in. But I take your point that without health care and basic security, I mean, Gabriel, this comes back to you perhaps. You think about individual initiative, and we're all for it, absolutely all for it. But if you've got a $16,000 baseline and your health care is shaky and you don't have much security, it's not a simple thing to get big masses of people up off the ground.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing that we discovered also by looking at all this data on income inequality is that even after you take into account all government transfers, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, Social Security, the earned income tax credit and everything, even after all those transfers, there's been very little growth for the bottom half of the distribution in the U.S. So not zero. This 0% growth was for pre-tax and transfer income. After tax and transfers, you've had a little bit of growth, maybe plus 20% since 1980 for the bottom half of the distribution.
Okay, good.
But in the face, the point that's very important, I think, is that given the dramatic changes that have happened to the pre-tax and transfer distribution of income, there's no amount of government redistribution, of transfers, that's going to be large enough to offset that trend, which means that if you really want to change things, you need to change the distribution of pre-tax and transfer income, which means equalizing human capital, which means having a higher minimum wage, you know, equalizing access to education, a stronger role for unions, for workers in corporate boards, and so on, and equalizing financial capital, so wealth, maybe with a steeply progressive wealth tax. That's the type of policy that would be really effective in reducing inequality in the United States, even more than increasing government spending on transfers or public goods.
We seem a long way from that right now. Walter, I keep thinking about your historical view of this and where we are right now. You hear the policies being talked about right there. When you look at inequality across time, what's your sense of why it matters? I mean, you know, we were told a long time ago that the poor will always be with us. But this is something else again. What's the impact on cultures when they have very great inequality versus those that have less great inequality, Walter?
Well, a great deal of change has already occurred because today the poor in developed countries are far less poor than they used to be.
Yeah.
So in that sense, inequality means something different from what it used to mean. Then again, you might argue that maybe inequality all by itself may have a destabilizing effect on societies or the political system. And that's really something I would like to look at next, because nobody has ever systematically looked at the relationship between very high or rising levels of inequality and some kind of political breakdown, civil war, revolution, and that sort of thing. To me, that doesn't seem to be a systematic relationship, but certainly inequality creates a potential through polarization, through the resentment that it generates, for destabilizing an existing political system. And that should certainly be a great source of worry for us in the U.S. today.
Steve Novick in Portland, Oregon, you're taking steps there. Where's your hope here?
Well, my hope is that numerous other jurisdictions will adopt our CEO pay ratio tax surcharge, and that will be part of a movement to restore, as you pointed out, the kind of ratios of CEO pay to typical worker pay that you saw in the 1960s. In the 1960s, the average CEO of a big company made about 20 times what the typical worker made, and we had an economy that was growing for all of us, and people had hope. I think that it has been destabilizing to see this huge increase in inequality. There's a lot of people that don't have any hope, don't believe in the American dream anymore. And Donald Trump, unfortunately, did a better job of harnessing that sentiment than Hillary Clinton did. When he said, make America great again, yes, white male supremacists thought about the restoration of white male supremacy, but I think a lot of other people thought back to a time when the economy seemed to be working for everybody. And we on the left have to do a better job of talking about policies and implementing policies that are designed to make the economy work for everybody again.
Where do you think this inequality is pushing our politics right now? I mean, you just stood for re-election, and I don't think you made it there, Steve, in Portland.
Yeah, I lost my reelection. In Portland, the hottest issue right now, which actually relates to inequality, is rising housing prices and rising homelessness. And I did not have an immediate solution to those problems. Rent control might be an option, but it's not allowed by the state here in Portland. And I know a lot of even liberal economists say it has unintended consequences. My opponent ran on a strong Rent Control Now platform, and she was successful.
There it goes.
Okay, that's Portland, where you'll have somebody who's proposing a tax on companies that pay their CEOs too much, losing to a candidate on the left. It's kind of, in a way, it's kind of delightful that it didn't like losing.
Steve Novick, Commissioner for the City of Portland. Thanks very much for being with us today, Steve.
Thank you.
Gabriel Zuckman, we're so grateful for your research. Do you have some optimism here, or are we just waiting for Walter Scheidel's World War or bubonic plague to fix it?
No, I think that there's a big role for states and local governments. Even during the Trump administration, we've seen, for instance, that the federal minimum wage has been stuck over the last decades, but at the local and state level, it has increased. And so if, states adopt more progressive...
Forgive me, Gabriel, we're out of time right there. Gabriel Zuckman at University of California, Berkeley, Walter Scheidel at Stanford, The Great Leveler is his book. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.